June, where do you want to begin this entire story?
So we're going to rewind back to last August when the Padres and the Rangers were playing each other.
It is game one of a home-and-home series between the San Diego Padres and the Texas Rangers.
It's the eighth inning.
All right, thanks very much, guys. As we move along here to the eighth inning, Juan Nicasio takes over for Texas.
The Padres are up by 7 runs, and the bases are loaded.
That is ball 4, and another walk this inning. Nicasio's second. This will load the bases for the Padres.
Fernando Tatis Jr., who's one of baseball's brightest young stars, he comes up to the plate, and he works a 3-0 count. Now, traditionally in baseball, you're supposed to not swing in the situation because it could be interpreted as trying to run up the score, especially with the Padres up by 7 runs. And Tatis's manager, Jason Tingler, basically sends him a sign to lay off on the next pitch. But Tatis doesn't see the sign, and he crushes the ball out of the ballpark.
This is in the air to right field. Back it goes. Nando has done it again. Fernando Tatis Jr., a grand slam.
And hits a grand slam. And so what happens after that is basically pretty familiar to a lot of baseball fans, which is Tatis being the center of criticism for violating the unwritten rules of trying to run up the score.
Yeah, I didn't like it, personally. You know, when you're up by 7 in the eighth inning, it's typically not a good time to swing 3-0.
And then something weird started happening, which I hadn't seen a lot in baseball culture in general, was that people really came out in full force and started defending him.
This is professional baseball. You play to the end.
You know, I think you got to keep in mind is the player's game.
Tatis is a junior. He is not a child. So stop demanding to be treated with kid gloves. It's time to get out of your feelings, baseball boomers.
And it wasn't just media members. It was players tweeting out that Tatis did nothing wrong. And so I think that this kind of shows this massive cultural change that we're seeing right now and how athletes on the diamond are shifting their attitudes about the unwritten rules.
For about a century, our national pastime has been ruled by customs that feel like commandments, delivered religiously from on high. But as a younger, flashier generation fills the pews and dugouts of Major League Baseball, the difference between sin and virtue is blurring right before our eyes. Today, June Lee explains an old sport's New Testament and how finally breaking with tradition could solidify the future of the game. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, April 12th. This is ESPN Daily. June Lee, I feel like I bring you on because you're like our youth sports correspondent. And by that, I mean you are youthful. When were you born again?
1995.
Yeah, every time you say that, it makes me grapple with my own mortality. June Lee is a staff writer for ESPN and ESPN Daily's most trusted Gen Z voice.
I also grapple with my own mortality on a day-to-day basis, trying to figure out like what I'm supposed to do with myself.
Well, baseball seems to be doing that exact same thing, which is why we're talking today, Jude. I need you to explain for those who are uninitiated into the culture of baseball what these unwritten rules even are and where they came from.
So I think they kind of parallel a lot of like American workplace etiquette in that they basically boil down to don't showboat, and also by always putting the team above the individual. If you kind of put yourself out there in a way that potentially offends another person or makes someone feel bad about themselves, there's going to be consequences. They're going to throw a pitch in the back, whether that's to you or the guy behind you.
Yeah, baseball is unique, June, in that there is this like quasi-permissible way a team or a pitcher especially can just retaliate for perceived slights by just throwing a 95-mile-an-hour fastball right at a human being. But I want to just lay out and drill down on the specific offenses that can set opponents off within this culture. What's the first or the biggest one that comes to mind for you?
Just no bat flipping or general shows of emotion and passion.
Because they do police like loving the home run you hit too much, right? Like, you're not supposed to pimp those. You're not supposed to be too demonstrative when you're walking to first base and rounding the bases.
You're supposed to not stare at the ball for too long. You're supposed to not carry the bat for too long. You're not supposed to stare at the pitcher or look at your dugout. There's so many small, like, emotional things that you just can't, you have to just pretend that like nothing happened and they're just moving forward. Everyone has a different idea of what the unwritten rules are and what's acceptable in what moment. And that's why we see these kind of cultural tensions kind of flare up pretty regularly in the sport.
June, when we talk about unwritten rules, it feels like a good question to ask at the top here is why these rules are not written down. Like, how are these codified? How obvious is it that these are, in fact, the principles, the rules of this game?
I think it has to do with power. And I think it has to do with old generations wanting to pass down tradition. Because more so than any other sport, baseball is so nostalgic about its history. And baseball, I think, has such a fascinating cultural history. And I think this generation is taking some of those guidelines and kind of throwing them out the window in a way that I think is more blatant and in your face than it has been in the past.
We've seen these rules manifest over time, but I want to get to like the 90s, the early 2000s. What are some of the notable inflection points as this culture is concerned there?
So I think one of the first ones is Ken Griffey Jr., because he wore this backwards baseball cap. How dare he wear a backwards baseball cap? And Nike, as they do, leaned into that as this kind of cultural anarchist thing, which is, you know, in the grand scheme of like just etiquette, like wearing a backwards baseball hat being a kind of an anarchist cultural act is so hilarious because it's so tame. And then I think Griffey ultimately was this guy who was at this kind of inflection point in that. If you talk to Ken Griffey Jr., and I mean this is no offense to him, he's very different from the persona that you see on the Nike commercials. He's very laid back. He's pretty reserved. He is not this like raw, let's break down the system type of guy. He just was Ken Griffey Jr., one of the most talented baseball players ever, the son of a major leaguer, and he happened to wear his baseball cap backwards. You know, I talked to Eduardo Perez, who literally grew up with Ken Griffey Jr., in the Reds clubhouse in the 70s. They both wore their caps backwards. Eduardo was not as good a baseball player as Ken Griffey Jr. And when Eduardo got to the major leagues, he was told that he couldn't wear his cap backwards.
I think it was my first week in the big leagues. I am stretching out with the team and I had my hat on backwards. I remember this coming up to me, a veteran utility infielder, and saying, hey, turn that hat around. Let's go. This is the big leagues. This is in the minor leagues. And you're not junior.
And so there was only this like leeway given in Ken Griffey Jr. because he was Ken Griffey Jr. And it was for something as small as wearing your baseball cap the other way.
Yeah, I want to sort of pinpoint, June. I want to try and identify the moment, the inflection point when this stuff changed the most, it felt like. And your reporting here documents that there is one day in particular that you can sort of point to.
Jose Bautista's bat flip. So the 2015 American League Division Series, Game 5, and Jose Bautista hits a 3-run go-ahead homer in the 7th inning, and immediately, emotionally, he just throws his bat in the air. And Bautista circles the bases, and then the bench is clear because the pitcher starts jawing back at the Blue Jays dugout because he thought it was a violation of the sport's etiquette.
Tyson was in no mood for anything after not just the home run, but Bautista admiring the blast.
And so immediately thereafterwards, you saw this discussion about whether or not Bautista was just in that moment to flip his bat, really toss his bat in the air.
I mean, it was an all-time Hall of Gifts, Hall of Memes moment, June. First ballot.
100%. Like, I think I wrote in the story, like, it is truly one of the most, like, gif-able MLB moments of the last decades. It was one of the biggest social media moments for baseball in the last decade. It really forced baseball culture to confront why can't Jose Bautista bat flip in this massive, iconic playoff moment? Like, should he be allowed to express what was happening internally? It was the first time that I remember as a baseball fan seeing people really, really come out in full force and defend someone bat flipping that way because of the context of that moment. And the irony of all of this is that it's not like Bautista was hit the home run and then in his head he was like, all right, this is a big moment. I'm going to create this iconic moment. I'm going to throw my bat in the air. Like, it just happened. Like, I feel like only a psychopath could only calculate that kind of thing. And he doesn't even remember it happening in the first place.
Wait, he has no memory of this very historical meme occurring?
He has no memory. He said he blacked out and his memory doesn't come back until he's back in the dugout.
I kind of blacked out after the swing, hearing the roar of the crowd and the emotion of the moment. Like, I don't really recall anything in particular until I was kind of catching my breath back at the bench.
I mean, that does sound a little psychopathic, but it is also so incredibly human.
I think the irony is that, like, Bautista gets recognized on the street more for that moment, especially in Toronto, than anything else he's ever done in his career. And he was never a bat flipper.
It's kind of weird because I wasn't a notorious bat flipper. You know, I might have done it 2 or 3 times in my whole career.
He had basically struggled his entire career with kind of containing his emotions and potentially rubbing people the wrong way.
I've heard comments from guys that are like, oh, I thought you were an a-hole, or I thought you were, you know, a head. And, you know, once I got to know you, I understand, like, why you get so upset. And I'm like, man, I struggle with it myself. I can't really explain it. It's just the way that I handle things, you know, and I got better at it as I was getting older. But, you know, that was one of my biggest struggles in my career, was controlling my reaction or my temper at times.
Him being himself, which is an emotional, sometimes temperamental guy, and him reacting to strikeouts in some ways, rubbed other people the wrong way. So when he got to the major leagues, he told me that he was often working towards trying to contain his emotions and bottle his emotions up.
I mean, it was for me difficult for sure. It's just, you know, hey, listen, you don't let it affect the next time. Don't get so upset because, you know, some people might perceive it in a negative way, or it might stick with you longer than might affect you, you know, down the road or the next day. Or,
but his ultimate legacy is this incredibly raw emotional moment that he doesn't even remember.
So Jose Bautista had lived his life, he'd played the game throughout his career, like trying to suppress that spotlight on self, trying to not be the individualist bat chucking dude. And then he realizes that he is who he is when this thing happens.
Right. His most iconic moment is also his most authentic moment.
And authenticity does feel like a virtue of your generation. That is a North Star. So when you talk to some of the younger players in the league, guys around the game who are coming of age when that bat flip happened, how did that impact them?
I specifically talked to Taylor Trammell, and Taylor Trammell is an outfielder for the Seattle Mariners. And he told me that he was in high school when he saw Bautista's bat flip, and he was at a showcase literally the next day, and literally everyone was imitating the Bautista moment.
I was just like, oh my goodness. And so, like, immediately we get to the field, everybody's doing, like, imitating it. I'm doing it from the left side. I'm like, dude, I'm throwing the bat up, and, like, we're chucking the bat like 20 feet in the air. Like, we're humming that thing. And it was like, wow, we're having so much fun.
And it was this feeling that, oh, I can do that too now, because there's enough people who are defending Bautista's authenticity in that moment to feel like I can now fully be myself.
He was like a pioneer of that, kind of like that, you know, breaking the glass and saying, like, let the floodgates roll in, you know.
So I want to fast forward, June, to last season, because that's when the moment you talked to me about at the very beginning of the show, the Tatis Grand Slam, occurred. How would you sum up how that moment was reacted to by today's players when they saw that?
So there was the initial reaction, which was Tatis apologizing and Jace Tingler and Chris Woodward, the Rangers manager, criticizing Tatis for, in theory, running up the score. But then when you go on Twitter, and I think this is also emblematic of the generational gap in baseball, where you saw players tweeting out their opinion of the moment.
There's no way I'm telling him to calm it down. There's no way that I'm going to scold him for swinging on a 3-0 pitch because he's competing.
You know, I think the unwritten rule in that situation would be like if Tatis like showed the other team up or something, which he didn't do at all.
I would have liked for his manager to kind of come to his defense a little bit and not necessarily make him apologize the way that it ended up happening.
You saw a bunch of players tweeting, it was fine. It's on the pitcher to make a better pitch in that moment. It is not your fault that you did your job and hit a home run. And then you saw Jace Tingler back up Tatis the next day.
Tatis was locked in. He did what he was supposed to do with that pitch. He just didn't look down and get the sign. And at the end of the day, like, I'm happy the 21-year-old missed the sign there and opened up the game.
I think 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, baseball players didn't really tweet about anything. If something happened on a different team, if something happened just in the sport, people just kept their opinions to themselves. I think we saw this kind of cultural shift happen with the Astros scandal, where something so egregiously bad happened that people had to express their anger on social media. And then after the killing of George Floyd, you saw a lot of baseball players speaking up about Black Lives Matter for the first time. And so players now feel this leeway to speak their mind on social media, more emblematic of the way that maybe a basketball player would.
All right, June, after the break, I want to talk about why these unwritten rules are starting to fall apart and what comes next.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
June, I zoom out on sports and I look around and I see not just NBA players being deeply individualistic. I think of Rob Gronkowski spiking football. I think of soccer players ripping their shirts off and facing the crowd like they're Russell Crowe in Gladiator. Why is baseball this outlier among sports?
Baseball is only confronting these issues at literally the last possible moment. It has procrastinated on its own homework assignment. Notice everyone else has jumped far ahead and is now realizing maybe, you know, I think partially from a cultural standpoint, but also very cynically from a capitalistic standpoint, this is the direction the country is headed.
But to even further extend this metaphor, June, it would seem to me that they've been procrastinating on this for a very, very, very long time. Does that seem right to you? How far back do these unwritten rules actually go?
One of the sport's original unwritten rules was don't sign a black player. That was an unspoken agreement among all the owners. So for Jackie Robinson, he entered the sport with all of these unwritten rules as the first minority. Don't show your emotions, keep everything internal. And I think that foundation has kind of spread culturally through other parts of the sport and how other minorities within the sport specifically, and also other white players as well, are willing to kind of portray themselves on the baseball field in terms of their emotions and how they kind of deal with all of that. As much as someone like Jackie Robinson or Hank Aaron or Roberto Clemente are celebrated as these massive heroes off the field in baseball, in the moment, they were villains to a lot of people. Social justice work that they did in the moment, Hank Aaron literally just being Hank Aaron and hitting all those homers, it was vilified in that moment.
So, June, I am thinking of all the names that we've sort of thrown around here, and it strikes me that so many of them, Fernando Tatis Jr., Jose Bautista, Carlos Gomez, they all come from the same place. They come from the Dominican Republic. There would seem to be some connection there, and I'm wondering how that interplay between the culture of origin for those guys and how they've been accepted or not accepted by baseball culture, how did that all fit together as these rules are concerned?
It fits together because, you know, a guy like Carlos Gomez and Fernando Tatis Jr., they play baseball culturally a certain way. And then guys come over to the United States and then there's just a completely different set of rules. And they come to America and they basically have a crash course in learning all of the etiquette things that they have never once thought about in their lives and are now being forced to learn in order to not make others in the sport angry. There has been a full force rejection of it up until very, very recently.
And with Carlos Gomez, who you talked to for this story, who is Dominican, who is Afro-Latino, those sort of cultural norms that got imposed on him, it seems like he really struggled with that for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, he was obviously just kind of a flashpoint for a lot of these unwritten rules discussions over the course last decade of his career.
Carlos Gomez up in the two spot tonight. And he hits that one high and deep left center field, way back and gone. Carlos Gomez standing there watching the baseball. And now Freddie Freeman joins in with Paul Mahalam as they shout at Gomez around the bases.
And Brian McCann, Mahalam, and Freddie Freeman very upset with Carlos Gomez.
And you know, there were whenever these kinds of incidents flared up, when he went on social media, you know, people were calling him a thug, which obviously has racist overtones to it. There was a level of emotional impact there where he told me that he would have trouble sleeping at night.
Some point in my career that hurt me that I'm kind of depressed, no sleep, crying. I know that I'm not a bad person. I guess I'm guy that loved playing baseball.
He had depression because of people basically calling him a criminal for the way that he played baseball on the field.
And so in some part of my career, that affect me in the point that I come to the ballpark like angry. When I get to the field, I'm just an angry tiger, like, whatever, I just gonna play hard I can. I gonna hit the ball and do whatever I want. And I'm gonna start like, no, Carlos, it's not like that. You need to do it in the right way.
And the thing he kept saying to me over the course of our interview was like,
I'm not a bad guy. I'm married when I'm 20 years old, still want my wife, and try to take care and support the city that I play, the people that I love, and I never out of the baseball field have any controversy, any problem. When I'm cross the line, I just feel like I'm just a kid playing baseball. I'm not thinking like it's my job. I just think like it's a game that I always love and play. So I just forget everything and just live in that moment. And people misunderstand the way that I'm expressed.
Because of the way I express my emotions on the baseball field, people are calling me a thug. And he told me that it really bothered him for a long time until he realized that he doesn't care what other people think anymore.
This is the world we live in. So I understand. Be happy yourself. Do what your heart thinks is good. Take care of your teammate. That's why all the teammates love me. You know, I never have a problem with my teammate. Oh, I have all the contact. Like, they always test me, asking me how I do it. And I'm retired, and they still test me. Why? Because I did my job right.
So all of these demographic changes, June, that are changing the literal faces of the game, I want to understand better how that is intersecting with the generational changes that are also shifting how this sport is sort of treated.
Yeah, I mean, part of it has to do with the fact that social media is what brings young fans to the sport a lot. Baseball has struggled in kind of creating a social media culture, I think, online until the last couple of years, where now you're starting to see players, you know, tweet out about the game that they played or posting lowlights. Like Christian Yelich the other day fell down on the field while trying to field a ball that was his way, and then he tweeted about it after the game. And that's something that I think you saw in the NBA for years, but is only now kind of getting to baseball, where players have enough like self-awareness and willingness to make fun of themselves to post things like that. And then there's also just the fact that a guy hitting a home run and then just running around the bases emotionless doesn't make for a good social media clip. Like, that's not something that is going to be posted on the SportsCenter Instagram account. But what is going to be posted on the SportsCenter Instagram account is a emphatic bat flip, or something where guys are showing emotions and there is kind of a maybe a wrestling type of soap operatic aspect to all of this.
I love how Major League Baseball has basically in the last couple of years finally discovered going viral.
They've discovered the power of the internet like 25 years later.
It's a series of tubes, they thought. But no, actually, it is quite a bit more.
At the end of the day, I think baseball is realizing what makes it different from every other sport and how it markets, which is the multicultural aspect of it. And now if you look at how the sport is being marketed, the fact that Fernando Tatis is on the cover of MLB The Show doing a bat flip when literally 5 years ago, that was something that got Jose Bautista punched in the face is kind of, I think, a marker of where everything is headed.
So June, you are a creature of the internet. You made YouTube videos in your youth. You still make YouTube videos. You still are also in your youth. So that's all a very misleading characterization, I suppose. But as a young person, as our designated young person, what does success for baseball look like, do you think? What does the future, what does the optimistic future for Major League Baseball actually resemble?
I think it resembles being more in the cultural day-to-day discourse of sports and having storylines that fans can emotionally hold on to and invest in, like having a reason to tune into a random national television game that you're not necessarily a fan of either team, but there's a storyline in that game, whether it's beef or a player who's trying to accomplish something that fans can invest in and tune in for.
June Lee, our young sports correspondent, thank you for making me feel very young and also incredibly old at the same time.
Thank you, Mr. Washed Pablo Torre, for having me on.
I deserve that. Okay, up next, we take a trip to San Quentin State Prison in Northern California, where the Warriors discovered a rising star who made his NBA debut this weekend.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. San Quentin State Prison is a maximum security correctional facility just north of San Francisco, and it has the largest death row in our country. Golden State Warriors players like Steph Curry had been visiting San Quentin for 8 straight years before COVID, doing outreach, meeting with inmates, seeing for themselves what life is like inside our carceral state. But on those very same visits, the Warriors' front office, led by general manager Bob Myers, had this tradition. They'd play in an annual basketball game against the team of San Quentin inmates, which is how Curry and Myers and the Warriors all discovered a prospect nicknamed Showtime. But Aaron Showtime Taylor wasn't a player. He was the announcer.
San Quentin Populous, welcome to the 2018 season, 5 years into the new age of Aquarius. Jack that thing up, feed the ball over to half man, half amazing. He's looking at Khalid like he's fresh meat.
Aaron Taylor had committed serious crimes before arriving at San Quentin. Things he'd openly discussed with The Athletic's Marcus Thompson, saying he'd once been resigned to life as an addict with a pistol. Taylor eventually got locked up in 94 after trying to rob an LA furniture store with a gun, only to get shot in the face by an employee, and then get sent to prison for 26 years. By every account, Taylor went on to spend those 26 years owning up to his crimes, rehabilitating himself, going to therapy, making peace with his victims, and finding religion. Not to mention his new calling. At San Quentin, Taylor would call games of Madden, marbles, baseball, anything and everything, basically. But most of all, as the documentary Cue Ball captured, he was the voice of any basketball game that mattered, which is how he got his new nickname. In fact, when Showtime received an email from Golden State last month, he'd already been out on parole and living in a halfway house back in LA, where he'd started calling games for the Venice Basketball League. All of which is why, on Saturday night in San Francisco, before the Warriors played the Rockets, Steph Curry recognized a familiar face and voice handling the pregame intros courtside. From Davidson, number 30, Stephen Curry, a.k.a. the Babyface Assassin. After the game, Showtime and Steph stood right next to each other on that court, celebrating the win and fielding questions. And it became very clear very quickly that the guy who dropped 38 was not the night's biggest star.
I mean, this is Hollywood, man. This is you just seizing your moment.
No, it's, I mean, I worked hard, you know, in 26 years to rehabilitate myself. And, in the process of doing that, I just embraced the attitude that I could be more than what I was, you know.
That is who Aaron Taylor is now, a prospect who's earned his nickname and a calling. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.